Batch Boy. Overlooking Phoenix. From high above in the Star Worldwide Network studios. Batch Boys. Stories, insight, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. And now, here they are, the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to another edition of the Badge Boys, a show where two cops talk to the community. I'm retired silent witness sergeant Darren Birch.
Retired Phoenix police officer Jason Schechterly.
And we had such a great time with last week's guest, retired detective Jack Ballantyne from the homicide and a murder for hire hitman undercover, that we had to have him back. We just ran out of time. So stay tuned, stay informed, and most of all, you're going to be entertained.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to Badge Boys, everybody. Awesome. And excited again. 2 weeks in a row, I've got one of my closest friends and my mentor from my days in a homicide, Jack Ballantyne. And just a quick background, because I want to get into this case and talk about it. But after my accident, I was off work for 18 months, dedicated to going back to work, came back as a public information officer and going through therapy, going through surgeries, doing kind of an office job. And Jack was on the third floor. I was on the first floor. He'd come down and visit me. And we'd talk. We'd go to lunch. And I'd still pick his brain, still daydream. And one day, Jack called me, and he just simply said, I'll never forget this, he said, how would you like for your business card to read homicide detective? And I got tears in my eyes. I'm like, you got to be kidding me. And Jack was responsible, along with some great supervisors above him, that gave me the opportunity. And I was a know-nothing. Listen, I was not outside of his detective class and my certification. I did not have the training. But I could listen to some jail tapes. I could run to the court and get subpoenas signed. I could do a few little things and just be around these guys. But then got to work some cases, and I got very disappointed because almost right when I get there, Jack gets taken away and put on a special assignment.
He was a go-to guy.
Well, it was a special assignment. It was going to last a year. So he was basically like, well, hey, welcome up here, but I'm not going to really be able to go on cases with you or teach you. And I had some great – listen, the detectives that I worked with were just awesome guys. My squad was awesome. So Jack finally comes back from his special assignment. I'm like, yes, day one. Supposed to be easy, right? No problem. Just going to cruise through the day. We're going to go to lunch. And relatively early in the day, we get a call that a body has been found way out west in a farm field. That's all we know. We get out there from patrol. That's all we know. There's a young man laying dead in a gruesome, gruesome murder. And all you see around is farm fields, the little tiny dirt service road that the farmers would use. He was laying on the side of that. And we are out in the middle of nowhere, West Phoenix. And Jack said, you know, I'm the case agent. You're going to work it with me. And that started, if I remember correctly, about 9 straight days of not going home, not doing anything, but working this case. And it was the most one of the most beautiful things that I ever was a part of, to watch how this unfolded and how it came to a conclusion. But I do not want to tell the story because Jack was a case agent, and that is what we're going to talk about. And I still to this day call it the killing of Gabe.
Aww.
So Jack, take us through that case. What happened?
Well, thanks for having me back again, you guys.
Love to have you.
Of course. Nice to be here. And, you know, that one thing, a couple things that I want to add to what Jason was saying is that, you know, originally when he came back to work, they were doing a great job of giving him some place to be, but it wasn't using him the way that he needed to be used, and it was causing him to be bored, really, is what it was coming down to. And he had such a strong, that's why I was so attracted to him as a friend when he was in my detective classes. He just loved the knowledge, and he loved the investigations and wanted to be such a part of it for the rest of his life.
You could see his excitement.
Oh, my God, it was amazing. In fact, it drove me nuts. It was too much. He wouldn't leave me alone.
It was annoyingly amazing.
That doesn't surprise any of us.
Jason, I got to go now. Well, let me ask you this.
One last question.
One more thing. You know, another hour later. So bringing him up into homicide, he was already detective trained and certified, and so he understood the process, and he was so inquisitive. That was a great mind to have in homicide. And when you hear him say this murder was the most beautiful thing he had ever been involved in, you have to understand from the eyes of a homicide investigator, we become so emotionally involved in that person that's life has been taken. And I don't care who you are, we all believed this. Every one of them that we worked with, we all believed, I don't care what happened in your life that led to you being murdered. You know, if you were involved in a life of crime or whatever, you still have somebody that loves you.
You're somebody's baby.
There's somebody that cared enough about you that your loss will impact them forever. And so it was important for us to be their voice because there's nothing they could do. And we became so involved in it that we wouldn't go to sleep. We may crawl under our desk and get an hour, or may run home and get a shower and just grab 2 hours. We may go for 2 days.
You jump on those leads.
You wouldn't, while it was still, you always hear that thing is that first 48 hours. Well, there's a lot of truth to that, you know, while it's still hot before people start forgetting about it and moving on to something else. And so the chase was intoxicating, wasn't it, Jason?
Oh, it's so intoxicating. And when pieces start to come, I still have memories of that case, little details that of how you go from, again, it's a tragic scene. It's going to affect you in certain ways. It's not a job for everybody. But like you said, you immediately start caring about who they are, their family, and you have to be their voice. And most importantly to me, whoever did this, when I looked at him, Gabe was, he was shot with a shotgun 3 times. His neck was taken out.
His arm.
And you could see on his face.
The horror?
No. It was my memory, like looking at him. And I saw a lot of murder victims. I saw a lot of suicides. I've seen a lot of violent, ugly death. Gabe's face was so innocent and peaceful that you knew right away, like, I don't know how this happened yet, but we're going to find out. And you definitely did not deserve this at all. And
no, nobody deserves to be, first of all, to be killed. Nobody deserves that. And then add to this, be taken out into a, I don't know if it was a cornfield or they were doing in this huge farming field out there. It was like 115th Avenue, so it's all farming community. And whoever killed him brought him up on that service road and then shot him and pushed him down into the canal area. Down off of the berm, down into this dirt, into this filth, and left him there. And, you know, it's just the whole thing is really tragic. And then when you find out about Gabe was a Mexican national that was working at a bar at the time, a big club called Graham Central Station, and he was a bar back. Everybody in there loved Gabe. Everybody.
Yeah, this guy has friends like I've never seen.
Yeah, from the patrons and to the workers, everybody loved him. He was a hard worker. He treated everybody right. Just a good guy. So to see something like this happen is unbelievable. And when we're sitting out there, we got nothing. Nothing.
It's a body dump. Hey, say
it,
that.
It really, it is. I mean, we know the murder occurred there. We got nothing but some little broken parts of a car.
My own personal favorite memory in this, because again, Jack's the case agent, and Jack has worked, so many homicides for so many years, and I'm still very new to this. And really, all we had at the scene was one of those little plastic fuse box covers, and it had a very faint number imprinted, like an 11-digit number.
Yeah.
And so we went back to the office, and now we're out there for a while. We're at the scene for a very long time.
It looked to us, Jason, didn't it, that it got, when he got pulled out of the vehicle, he probably kicked it.
Yes.
And it broke and came out of the vehicle.
But almost each and every case, you need one little break. You need one little piece of luck, and that at the time.
It just had a part number on it.
Had that not been there, we still would have solved this case. But had that not been there, I think it would have taken a little bit longer. But I simply called the first Napa Auto Parts. You know, this is early 2005, I think.
Okay.
And I called the first Napa Auto Parts that came up on Google at the time in my office. And I was like, hey, can you tell me what this is? And it's, again, if you're not in law enforcement, you're not able to understand the emotional investment. When the guy was like, yeah, I could tell you exactly what car that came from. What type? Not whose.
Right, right.
But he came back.
Yeah, make model.
He came back with the make and model. And I think I ran. And me and Jack's office was about 8 feet apart. But I was in a dead sprint from my chair to his. Like, I found something. Because for me, it was something to be very
proud of. Absolutely.
And it was huge because now we're looking for a car. And we didn't know right away whose car it was, but I think his friends helped us pretty quick that he left work that night driving that make and model car. Now we have to find
it. How huge is that?
Now we have to find it, and then...
Because that's what's happening. We're with this part, then we're starting to identify a similar situation where some friends of his are looking for their missing friend. And we're able to tie that in, and then we find out that the vehicle of the friend is the same vehicle that this part belongs to. Then they tell us where the vehicle is at, and it was involved in a bunch of crimes on the reservation, and it was in storage at the time, a tow lot. Mm-hmm. So we were able to recover that.
All that documentation.
It just started
snowballing,
coming
dominoes.
And can I interject something here? I know I'm the only one in this room right now that's not ever been part of law enforcement. And Jason, let me tell you something. Us normal people that have never been behind the badge, the enthusiasm that you expressed in just that one clue to solve a case, it makes the normal people like me really feel good about law enforcement, because if there's someone out there that says the police are not doing their job to get to the bottom of a crime quick enough, look at what you guys did. One little tiny piece.
Yeah, and you know, I appreciate Jack's honesty because I am overly enthusiastic sometimes. Sometimes I use the wrong words about, but I loved being a part of this. This was what I was meant to be doing. I didn't do it for as long as I wanted to, but I truly loved being...
This was a dream for you.
I loved being around these cases. I loved being around the detectives. I loved being around the families and the victims. Yeah, to solve a homicide,
does it get bigger?
I'm sure a brain surgeon would tell you, listen, there's nothing more special than operating on somebody's brain. I can't do it. But for me, there's nothing more special.
It's really true what he's saying. And when you talk about the commitment and the passion for doing this, you know, he was just recovering from everything that he had been through and all the trauma that had happened to his body and what had happened to his eyes. And you know, I know we're talking about Gabe's case, but what finally came to an end for Jason being able to work, it wasn't that Jason didn't want to continue doing this till the day Jason died. It was that this constant going for day upon day upon day upon day and not sleeping We ended up being out on a case that we did that for days. It happened to be an officer that was killed in the middle of a street, in the middle of the street.
David Uribe.
Oh. And
Jack was the case agent.
Yeah, worked with his son.
Jason's eyes started to bleed.
Mm. Yeah, we were out there for a long time.
Because he would not give them enough rest because he was so committed to finding the people and holding them responsible for what they had done.
Which he
and
did.
And he did that in every one of the cases. But they just started to bleed so much that it was really the end of him being able to do this. The trauma was too much for him. But, in the Gabe case, it was the same thing. We just went for days upon days without any rest, kept following these leads upon leads. And it eventually what it did is it took us to a story where Gabe had come into town and he met a girl while he was getting some fuel, I believe.
Middle of the night. After work. Yeah, he got up to work as a barber.
She asked for a ride, and he agreed to give her a ride. And she took him, I need to stop and see a friend of mine real quick and grab something. This is all normal.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah,
and
guys
so,
and girls.
So, yeah, he takes her to the friend. The friend comes out, gets in the car. He had a shotgun stored in his pants. And that's when they took Gabe at that moment. They took his vehicle. They took his wallet. They took everything. Put him as somebody that they have
kidnapped.
You know, a victim that they're going to kidnap. They kept him in the car. And then they took him out to that field. And they killed him out in that field. We were able to piece all of this together to start getting all the individuals involved. Little by little by little, and it finally got us to the Gila River Reservation. And that in and of itself is another story.
But it can be difficult.
It's so difficult because it's a sovereign nation.
Yeah,
so
you have
so
no
being able, you have we have nothing.
We have nothing.
We couldn't be armed. We had
you have to get permission just to get there.
We had to get permission for that. We had to get permission to come on. We had to work with their people. And they eventually helped us identify the girl we were looking for, and then we found her. And it was almost priceless to watch the night that they got onto her. We're in the community.
And those are difficult to even find because it's like X amount of miles past the cow.
And we're the pursuit is on to chase her and get her. And we end up rolling up, he doesn't even know what's going on because it just happens.
It truly was like being on TV. Nothing happens like it does on TV. And I always say that. Nothing. TV is fake. We had, and before that, we had gone to the casino to speak to somebody who works there at the casino saying, hey, we're looking for this person. And we heard that she comes in here. And as we're talking, the guy says, well, her mom is sitting right there at the slot machine. And I remember thinking,
no,
that's not possible.
And nobody's that lucky.
He points at the, you know, the live circuit TV and he says, that's her mom. And then I got to sit
back. Timing's everything.
Then I had the privilege of sitting back and watching, you know, right away we pulled her in and did an interview immediately. But half of me was still, it was surreal. Like,
sure.
How in the world did this, did this fall into place this way? And
right place, right time.
And yeah, it was. I mean, what are the chances you're looking for somebody and their relative is sitting at the slot machine of the casino you're at? This does not happen. We don't live in the TV world. It was, but these are, when you're involved in these cases, Robin, like you brought up, as a police officer, when you get these kind of breaks,
you
those,
run with it.
Those are the ones, though, that they, again, I know we're talking about murder, and I know I use the wrong term sometimes because I'm
but it's that I'm, that zeal I'm for ridiculous. Justice
it is you're the good feelings that you have from that, and it motivates you to go, okay, what's the next step and what's
well,
the next step
it causes you to
step?
Celebrate.
And you know, it's not being excited about murder, guys, it's being excited about justice.
Zeal
for
justice for the victim.
Well, and this mom you just said it right there. I'm sorry I even talked over you. It is. It's justice for the victim.
Yeah.
It's that voice and that justice. Mm-hmm. But the mom ended up giving us everything on her because the mom had taken the credit card from Gabe and they were giving gas. They were anybody out at the out that had cash out on the reservation got gas, and they would give the cash to them, and then they would run off and,
gotcha.
And spend the money doing whatever they wanted to do. But just, you know, in closing, when we finally got her, the reservation police met us at an at a street. It was like 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning. It was something out of a movie. And we were on one side of the street, they were on the other side of the street, and we met. They pulled her out of the vehicle, and we met in the middle.
Across the border.
And they handed her off to us, and then we were able to take her.
And that was, and let me fill in one little gap. Jack mentioned earlier that the friend that she stopped to pick up, that, you know, the innocent little thing, and he got in the car with a shotgun down his pants. He was not the shooter. The girl that we're talking about executed Gabe.
Cold,
and again,
killer.
When you're shot with a shotgun, and he was shot three times, it is devastating.
She's a bad person.
Seth Rowe. She's one of the few females.
Yeah, she.
That gives me chills.
Samantha Sommergustava. I'll never forget this woman's name. But I got to tell another great story to part of this. Part of getting her convicted and after the fact, because she wasn't going to tell us the truth. She had nothing to do with this, right? She wasn't. He dropped her off. She left him safe and sound. We knew nothing. Well, when we found out about her friend and we were able to get him, he wasn't the killer. He wasn't the shooter. You think he wanted to go to jail for that?
Rolled over.
No. So back then, again, this is, you know, 14, 15 years ago, we videotaped our interviews for court purposes. It's very important. And I didn't have the skills to be one of the interviewers. And I would be in the little monitoring room. Well, Jack was in interviewing this guy. And I'm just sitting there. I can't even tell you. Prayers, enthusiasm, like, please, please, please say what we need you to say. Give it up. Give us the details that nobody else is going to know. And they're about halfway through the interview. And Jack is Jack's incredibly skilled homicide detective, a skilled interviewer, and he is pretty intimidating. And
big guy.
Halfway through the interview, on video, the guy stops him and says, "Sir, I think I'm going to go number two."
Did he say number two?
He did. That was my favorite part.
Thank you.
He didn't say I needed to go to the restroom. He said, "I think I'm going to go number two." But he not only did he think he was going to, he actually did in his pants. And I remember thinking, Jack just made this guy shit his pants.
Yeah, scared the shit out of him.
That's how he literally scared the shit out of him. But the guy gave us what we needed.
Love
and
it.
Again,
love it.
Soma Gustava, one of the most evil people, and I saw a lot of evil people. She was
evil,
and I still think about Gabe on a regular basis because of how that had that case impacted me personally.
And talking about Gabe, last week Jackie shared something with me, and I was hoping that you might touch upon it, elaborate when you talk about making a difference every day.
It was when I was way undercover, and you've already talked about how I looked and how bad I looked, and I had to go meet some people at a high-rise building. And so I come walking in. I'm filthy, but big and nasty. And I get into the elevator, and I'm by myself, and the door starts to close. Suddenly it stops, and it opens. And standing right outside is this old, old guy. But, oh, my God, is he dressed nice. He's dressed to the nines. He's got on a little fedora, and his clothes look pressed. He's on a cane, and he comes walking in, shuffles in, and he gets in, and the door closes. He looks at me, and I look at him, and I go, "Hey, how you doing?" And he goes, "I'm good. How you doing, son?" And I go, "Everything's good with me." I said, "It's all good." I said, "I can't wait for Friday." And he looks up at me, and he takes his little finger, he's got this little crooked finger, and he looks at me and he says, "Did you ever think about how many days in your life you skip and you miss out on because you're rushing to get to Friday? Had you ever thought about how many people you could help make a difference in their life if you just enjoyed every day like it was Friday?"
Hmm.
That's the wisdom and perspective.
I feel like my wind gets knocked out of
me. Yeah.
And the elevator stops. The door opens. He kind of looks back up at me, gives me a little head nod, and shuffles out the door. The elevator closes. And I'm just left there going, holy shit.
Didn't expect that.
What just happened? I couldn't get it out of my head. And forever I have lived by that thought, is that live every day like it's Friday. And with every day, start every day with the thought and the plan of making an opportunity to make a difference in somebody's
life. We may have to steal that for inspirational clothes.
Perspective is everything, and that's I love that it came from an older guy, and he took the time to wag his finger at, like, to make his point, and it made that impact. And Jack's not kidding; he has lived a life. Jack's safety and friendship still means the world to me, so I don't say too much. But his family, I am blessed to know very well. His wife is doing some incredible things. She has always treated me like one of her sons. His youngest son is just killing it in the world right now. And he was my witness in detective school. And I think he was 9 or 10 years old. And I didn't know that when I was interviewing him. Of course, I found out later.
And now he's a big rock star.
And Jack's wife. Yeah. Now he's a big rock star in LA. And Jack's wife was my victim that I'm trying to pass like a college course, basically, and this is who he brings in, is his wife and his son, and now they're all grown up, and his other son is actually saving lives on a daily basis, and he is almost my age, somebody I got to spend time with just a couple weeks ago. So that little elevator visit, Jack, it's great to share that story with our audience, but you have taken it to heart, and you have lived your life by that, and again, your service to justice, your service to the community. And for me personally, I know you know this, we've talked about it in many private personal settings, but I have nothing but incredible memories and motivation. And it was my 3 years in homicide for the stuff we had to see and deal with. I consider it life-saving for me. And look where I'm at now. And I credit you with that. So. I love you, and I thank you very much for that.
And I love you too. And I, you know, I always look at you as like a brother for me. And I've always told everybody, because I've been there with Jason through all of this. And there's two things that saved Jason's life, and his wife Susie.
Yes, what a love story.
Is absolutely the number one. Without Susie, I don't think Jason would still be here today. And then the other is that opportunity to be an investigator and make a difference in those lives and the other families is
when you work on something that much bigger than you, and you are working with those families and speaking for those victims, they never leave you. The David Uribe case, I mean, to lose one of our officers and to be a part of what you did and what the entire, Darren, you were working at the time.
Oh, Adam, his son, worked with me.
I mean, Adam was on duty when his dad was shot and killed. It's 11:30 in the morning at 3400 West Cactus. And it was unbelievable to see how we all came together. And another person, he was 18 at the time, Donnie Delahanty, he's on death row. The guy driving the car, I think he got 27 years. We spent quite a time with these individuals. These cases, they never leave you, and I'm very proud to have been a part of them.
You know, with your loss in your life, you know the value of somebody that cares enough about you to do whatever it takes to try to make things right.
Absolutely.
And to be there, thank you, to support you, and how hard it is for what you're going through.
So I can only imagine the love that Jason has for you, because I know exactly what you're talking about. When that detective, when that individual comes into your life at the worst time possible, and he has your back, I got chills. It's everything.
It truly is. So Thank you, Jack. I want to remind everybody, his book, Murder for Hire, we talked about it last week. And great read that. You can contribute to the Hunter Club through it. His generosity continues. But the book is incredible. And Murder for Hire, I mean, I was a cop, and I still find it to be so fat. Like, I could have never done that undercover stuff. I just...
And you're tall and big. I'm tiny. I could have done it in a million years.
You know, whether it be the biker stuff or some other special project stuff that we call it that we don't talk about openly, or the Murder for Hire, that stuff is just... It's an awesome read. It's fun to get inside the minds of the criminals and people who... are fighting for
Mr.
justice.
Murder
so,
for Hire.
Go get that book. And Jack, thank you.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back with Cop Talk.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADA in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
I'll never forget
that moment.
As long as I live.
My first call ever as a member of the National Guard.
When we got to the armory, they briefed us on the wildfires. They were getting dangerously close to homes.
Helicopters were going out to drop water on the fires.
Guys in the unit were preparing for firefighting with local fire crews.
At that moment, I got my first taste of just how important the Guard is to my community.
See how the Guard can be an important part of your life at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired Police Sergeant Darren Birch and retired Police Officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Welcome back to Badge Boys, everybody. Outstanding segment with Jack Ballantyne, dear friend of mine, and always love to go down memory lane, talk about that case, even though it was incredibly sad and heart-wrenching. It's still... maybe hard to understand, but it's a fond memory of how it was resolved and the work we did for the family. So now we're going to get into Cop Talk. And ladies and gentlemen, this one's going to be pretty intense, I think. We're going to try and deal with the elephant in the room. Everybody, if you don't know what's going on here in the Valley, it's national news right now. Darren, we're going to talk about the video, the shoplifting, the Phoenix police officers who were so incredibly inappropriate. And we were talking before we went on air. If you hate cops, watch this video. It'll help you. If you love cops, watch this video. And if you are a cop, you have to watch this video.
No, I totally agree. I think there's two views to this video, basically. Those who hate cops, this video with this disgusting language filled with expletives is used in its exclusivity. In other words, by itself with no other information, no other facts. You just use it by itself to validate your hardened stance about hating cops.
Well,
and it validates that.
Let's give the audience a little bit of background. What video are we speaking about?
Yeah, we're talking about an incident at a dollar store. At this dollar store, and those who, and again, our show is national, and this is a perfect issue because this is national video now. But for those who live locally here in the Valley of the Sun in Phoenix, Arizona, the greater metropolitan area, you know this store is in the area of basically 24th Street and McDowell Road, I believe. And it's a dollar store. The call, there is no call that comes out regarding this incident, and that is something that surprised me because I've done some sound on different local radio shows about it because I didn't know how this came about. Was it a hot call? Was it an emergency in broadcast? What was it that made these officers so upset when we see the video? But what actually happens is there is a previous shoplifting call at this dollar store that these two officers are dealing with, and they're dealing with it fairly routinely, if you will. At the same time, unbeknownst to these police officers, is this family. And when I say family, I'm talking about the adult male. We're talking about a adult female, and we're talking about two kids. There's another adult female that is in another store, and she's pregnant. And the male and that pregnant female are a couple, and they have these children. And unfortunately for everyone, they decide they're going to do some shoplifting in this store. The male, which is later the driver, and we'll refer to him as the driver, he bends down and he basically shoplifts some underwear. The video shows him bending down, shows him selecting the items, shows him kind of spinning around, and then shows him walking out the store with this huge underwear bulge in his pants. And he walks out. The little girl has a doll. And now, of course, all the disingenuous media out there, and you know who you are if you're doing this, you say this is a an accidental Barbie, you know, walk away. That's not true. The little girl has this doll, and it's a nice sized doll. It's fairly large. I don't, to give it some type of dimension, it's a huge comic book size. For those who remember the big comic books in the days, it's you know, I don't know, like 12 inches by 12 inches or something like that. And she goes to the adult female who's in line, shows it to her, and the adult female shoos her away, and then she goes to her dad, and the dad kind of takes her out the store with it. I'm sorry, I put that on the parent. Now, of course, you're not going to put on the four-year-old girl, but I put that on the parent, obviously. These parents also walked into the store without money. And when the pregnant woman, who is the mother of this child, sees her daughter, knowing they didn't have money going into this store, which seems odd, she sees the doll in her daughter's hand and knows, oh, you know, she just walked out of that store stealing a doll. And when I say stealing, I mean the parents. And she should have stopped the child. She just should have done the right thing and had returned. Instead, they all run to the car because now the officer has been alerted by the store employees that another family is stealing things. And so he goes out, he tries to stop them, and this dad who'd stole the underwear throws the underwear out to the ground, and they all pile in this car, and they drive a short distance, and then the female, who is a friend apparently, who is in the store, who kind of shooed away the girl with the doll, she gets out because, you know what, she doesn't want anything to do with refusing to obey police, and she is left out, if you will. And then the family drives away at whatever rate of speed, and then the police, and then that's the end of the video, if you will, of the store. What you have is the end result, unfortunately, a mile down the road on, I want to say, Roosevelt and 32nd Street at apartment complex. You have the officers in a very heated exchange with the family in the car. And what's so bad about that exchange is, if you don't know anything else and you're just listening to that video, it's bad.
It's really bad.
Yeah. And tell us what you thought about that video.
Well, when I first saw it, some of the language that's used, I thought about two things. First of all, it's incredibly inappropriate. There is no need to talk to suspects of a shoplifting or a theft with that kind of language. The officer was incredibly amped up. But then immediately, my other thought was, what happened on the call before? What happened to him that morning in briefing? What happened at home? He's a human being, and I will, I'm the first one to say, you're a cop, you're under a little more smaller of a microscope, and you have to act accordingly. But he did not show up on that call, and all of a sudden, you know, lose it per se. But the video looks horrible. I did not enjoy watching it. It made me angry. It made me ashamed. And because, again, I know what the reaction is going to be. I know what the media is going to do. I know what politicians are going to do. And I know what the general public is going to do. They're going to paint all of us with that same brush. And that is absolute BS, because that's not how it should be done. But I knew there was more to the story. Paul Harvey's rest of the story from a long time ago. And that's why I'm glad we're talking about this. So give some context, Darren. Seriously, for someone like me, I had an emotional reaction to it. I did not take the time to research or, you know, call friends in the department and be like, hey, what's the real deal with this? But I know there's more to it. The officer saying certain things like, you know, I'm going to put a cap in your head. Terrible language. It should not have been said in that situation. That's my opinion. However, was he allowed to say that?
That's a great point. The phrase, I'm going to effing cap in your effing head, is definitely a volatile statement. And when you're doing a high-risk stop, you want to bring that high risk down. You want to control the situation. You want to be as professional as you can. You want to, especially when the people inside are communicating. They may not be doing what you want in terms of raising their hands.
De-escalation is your entire job.
De-escalate that, control it in a professional manner. If you act out of control, it will become out of control. So when we talk about how concerning, how unsettling watching that video and hearing, more importantly, hearing that video, we get it. Every cop gets it. Now to the point, was it not just out of line, if you will, was it unlawful? Is it, if you will, subject to, you know, some type of disciplinary action? And I will say no. And the reason I say no is there's a couple of laws that come in place here. When I came on the department, a law had just came out down from the Supreme Court. Is Tennessee versus Gardner. It was in 1985. And basically, I'll get really quick, back in the day in Tennessee, you could shoot, we're talking like pre-80s, you could shoot a fleeing felon, period. You could shoot them. Thankfully, and I do mean that, thankfully.
Yes. Thankfully, you can't do that.
Right. Thankfully, Tennessee versus Gardner came out, and they said, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
But they added more to it. What they said is you can't just shoot someone because they're – and by the way, they used the term not fleeing felon, which is what we all use. But it was a fleeing suspect, by the way. So it just meant any fleeing criminal you could not shoot unless – there was cause for concern to the greater public, i.e. this person was a danger, not just a lethal threat, but a dangerous threat. You could then shoot. And then the second thing that came out with that was you can, however, big however, threaten lethal force. You just can't use it. It's our bluff. In fact, me and Jason were talking about that before the show, how we, in interviews, we bluff people all the time.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, I got your evidence at the scene. If you know you're innocent, you know I'm bluffing.
Yeah.
So, but thankfully, it's worked a few times for me because I've had situations where they've stopped running. And I didn't have my gun out and I had no intention of shooting anyone.
Well, of course not.
But exactly. And as police, you just said, of course not. As police, that's what that means to us. Of course not. But the public doesn't know that.
Right.
The public is watching this video and they see this guy with a gun and saying, I'm going to put a cap in your effing head. They think he means it. And that's what's so scary. So when we talk about the legal aspect of it, and there's another aspect to this, by the way, and that was in 1989. It was, oh gosh, if I can remember it right, it was something versus Connor. It was Graham versus Connor in 1989. And that case was where you have the lawful right to detain someone, believing them to have committed a crime.
Right.
And that's what we now know that's that investigative detention, which they were lawfully permitted. So they were lawfully able to, even though they didn't arrest anyone, right? Because the end result, by the way, for you listening in the audience, the store did not prosecute. They did not have the officers' backs, in my opinion. I really believe that. They did not have the officers' backs because they did not prosecute. If you're not going to prosecute, then don't tell them chase someone down the street for some property. They did not prosecute. And so since they did not prosecute, the officers chose not to arrest him for other things. Because, by the way, you're not allowed to disobey a lawful command.
Right.
You're also not allowed to drive a vehicle without a license and was suspended. His license was suspended. That's also a bookable offense. He could have been arrested for that.
Right.
And you're also not allowed to drive away from a crime scene with your children not buckled in the vehicle.
In today's culture, according to the media and a lot of politicians, you very much should ignore a lawful order. That's part of the problem right now that the police are dealing with and that the public thinks that to be anti-police is one thing. To not like police, not like how they do things, that's fine if that's your opinion behind closed
and
doors.
And there may be experience.
To actively
disobey.
Believe that you can disobey a lawful order, that's the key here. It's not because somebody puts on a uniform and tells you to do something. That's how it is a lawful order that you are being given. And if you comply and let an officer do the investigation, things are not going to go what we call south.
Thank you for that. This is my point. Had that driver not went to that store and stole those items, we wouldn't have a video. If that driver had not gone to the store with his children to steal things, we wouldn't have that video. If that driver had have stayed at the scene when ordered to do so, we would have not have a video. Right. But because he did not comply, because he refused all commands, because he put the officer in a situation where the officer felt there was some type of threat, and I truly believe the officer felt there was a threat in that vehicle, because we all know it's scary not knowing what's in the vehicle, and that's why the officer was hyped up. He had just been driving at speeds to try to catch up to this vehicle. His authority was threatened. All these things, unfortunately, made him a little bit more exaggerated in terms of his aggravated state. He was aggravated. There's no denying it. He was aggravated. He was upset. Sure. He was angry. Sure. But had all those things, those were all on that driver. And the sad thing is, because he did all those things, he's now asking for a $10 million payday from the citizens of Phoenix. But, and that's wrong.
And you know what? To his credit, and I hate to even say this, but he did all those things wrong that led up. And that's all I talk about across this country is life is about choices. Every situation that you get into, there were a lot of choices made before that lead up to that. But once we get to the video, the driver did everything right. And that's what's scary. He said all the right things. He acted appropriately. And it makes the video a lot harder to watch. The optics of it are terrible. And yes, now all of a sudden, it's $10 million. That's what a few pairs of underwear or a doll are going to be worth, is $10 million from the city? No.
And we haven't talked about the aspect of guns pointed at children. This is, if you will, in police jargon, a high-risk stop. They felt it constituted that based on the driver failing to comply to the commands, driving from the scene, you have a fleeing suspect leaving a crime scene, albeit from a dollar store, and they felt it rose to a level of a high-risk stop. And I don't criticize them for that belief, because we don't know what's going on in that vehicle.
Right.
You know, guns are held in vehicles. They're hidden in vehicles. They're allowed to be in vehicles. You know, so they have every reason to be concerned when people aren't complying. Why aren't you complying? What are you hiding?
Right.
Are you, you know, a murder suspect somewhere? What is it that, why aren't you complying? The problem, and you nailed it on the head, Jason, is their demeanor, their voices, everything in those videos where you hear the sound, they are being compliant to the extent that they're not exiting the vehicle. They're saying, sir, the vehicle door is broken. Sir, I have a baby in my lap. They sound very nice.
And
I'm not even saying they're making that up. That's what they were at the point where they knew they were caught.
Right.
They knew that it was done. But now the officer's upset, and they're trying to calm the officer down. And that's what the video shows. It does. And here's my point. E.J. Montini wrote an article about officers and how, in fact, the headline is "Punish Bad Cops, but Not All Cops." And right now, people are painting a broad brush on all cops. And you're hearing on the media. The media is taking this thing and just exaggerating out of proportion.
Every cop is horrible. Every cop is racist. Every cop wants to commit murder. It is pretty unbelievable what is being said out there.
And keep in mind, as bad as that video is, as bad as it sounds, nobody was hurt. There was no shooting. Everyone got to go home. Nobody was put in jail when they could have, but they weren't.
Right.
And so Montini wrote an article. I love his article, because at that scene, there's also good cops that were talking to her, and we don't hear about this.
Of course not.
Yeah, one cop said, "What happened?" You know, very calm to her, and kind of de-escalated the situation. Yeah. And there were other officers who made decisions not to arrest them.
Right.
I love this article. Punish bad cops, but not all cops. Opinion. There is a temptation when police are involved in an ugly incident to paint an entire department with a broad brush. You can't do that. Here's why. And Montini continues. A few days ago, I ran into Jason Seckerly. Yes, that's right. Our very own Jason. I know, right? I love this when I was reading this. I know him.
Toilet paper aisle at Albertsons, guys. Not going to lie.
A few days ago, I ran into Jason Seckerly in the grocery store. He's doing well. It was great to see him. The name might not ring a bell. Of course, it does to our listeners. The name might not ring a bell if you haven't lived here long, or perhaps even if you have. In March 2001, when he was 28 and a Phoenix police officer, Checkley's patrol car was struck from behind by a taxi estimated to be going more than 100 miles per hour. The patrol car burst into flames, and he was trapped inside. By some miracle, if that's the right word for such an horror, and I would say it is, there was a Phoenix Fire Department truck near the intersection where the accident occurred. Checkerly was horribly burned, in a coma for months, endured scores of surgeries, and, eventually returned to duty. He became a homicide detective, retiring in 2006. Why we can't paint with a broad brush? I mention this because the entire city, the entire country, is justifiably outraged by now a viral video of Phoenix police officers screaming and cursing and pointing weapons at a couple of accused of shoplifting who had with them their two small children. Stupid, 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 Montini continues. There is a temptation when police are involved in an ugly incident like this to paint an entire department with a broad brush. I can't do that. My inclination, because the police willingly put their lives on the line for us each and every day, is to side with officers. I can't be convinced otherwise if the evidence is there, but I begin on the side of law enforcement. Over the years, I've seen what we ask of them and what can happen. I was at the scene of an incident in the mid-1980s when an officer struggled with a man outside a convenience store. The young man got a hold of the officer's gun and shot and killed him. I can speak to that. That was when I came on the department, and that officer was Bob Fike, yes. And that was in January of 1986.
Yes.
Another time, officer... Montini continues, another time officers were assigned to patrol my neighborhood after the usual threats a news columnist receives become a lot more serious. During one pass on my block, a patrol officer saw my front door open and swerved into my driveway, believing there might be trouble. There wasn't, but he didn't hesitate. The sacrifices I've seen from police, a year or two later, that same officer didn't hesitate to go to a neighborhood where there were reports of gunfire. A man with a rifle shot and killed him. That officer's name? Leonard Kalaji, and I worked with Leonard.
Leonard Kalaji. Never even got out of the car.
No.
Never even undid his seatbelt.
No,
he didn't. 20th Street and his
very sad. Yeah, we worked out a squad peak
horrible.
Together. Montini continues, I was at the scene in 2005 on Cactus Road between 31st and 35th Avenue, shortly after Phoenix Police Officer David Uribe was gunned down during a traffic stop. One of the detectives working that case was Jason Sheckerly, as we well know.
Yes.
Officers Eric White and Jason Wolf were killed in 2004 at an apartment complex near 19th Avenue and Northern Avenues. A few days later, they died. I watched kids running through the complex with one crime scene tape trailing like yellow ribbon behind them. I inherited that squad. That was 73 Frank squad, yep. And I had to work with
officers.
I was
on that scene as well.
And we didn't even talk about the officer driving that got into a fatal collision on the way there, by the way.
Oh, yes.
Yes. Montini continues. I visited a spot at 83rd Avenue and Canto Boulevard where Officer George Cortez Jr. was shot and killed in 2007 after responding to a forgery call at a check cashing operation.
Same day the news helicopters hit each other. Horrible day in the history of Phoenix.
I was working the front desk of the detective detail when I received the call about Cortez, yeah. As well as those two choppers going down.
Yeah.
I just worked a 10-hour shift at detectives and had no idea I was going to end up working the front desk. Oh, the worst day
that
in
was
Phoenix.
One of the most horrible days
horrible
ever in
yes
horrible.
It was. I lost friends that day too.
Thank you
on the
choppers. Yeah. Yeah,
and again that stemmed from a police chase, by the way, of a stolen mm-hmm. vehicle. We're treading on sacred ground. Montini continues, it's in what once had been farm country but now is filled with housing developments, apartments, complexes. He's talking about the Cortez shooting, restaurants and strip malls. I guess that no one who visits those businesses is aware he or she treads on sacred ground. In 1999, I visited a spot near 35th Avenue and Catalina where Officer Mark Atkinson was shot to death by suspects and drug traffickers.
The reason I became a police officer, Mark Atkinson.
Montini continues, at the base of the telephone pole where Atkinson's patrol car banged to a stop, someone left a small Bible, was tapped open to the book of John with the following passage highlighted in yellow. Quote, the greatest love a person can have for his friends is to give his life for them, end quote. The city erects small markers at the spots where Phoenix police officers have died in the line of duty. Each is about the size of a no parking sign with a blue background and stylized City of Phoenix logo, block letters, and the officer's name printed on it and the date the officer's, quote, end of watch. You've probably passed by one or two and not even noticed. Those end of watch signs you don't notice? Well, that's okay. The officers I met over the years don't expect you to pay attention to such things. They would hope, however, that we don't judge all of them based on the behavior of a few. If an officer oversteps the boundaries of police etiquette, he or she should be fired. I disagree. They should be punished, not necessarily fired, depending on the infraction, right. Quite frankly. But he continues, if there's a problem with attitude or behavior that permeates the department, that must be changed. And every officer in Phoenix should be equipped with body camera. But most of the officers I've known are like Jason Sheckerly, like Leonard Kalaji, like Bob Fike. That's me, I'm sorry. They're good people who wake up each morning, slip on bulletproof vests and a bunch of other equipment, place firearms in their holster, and go to work for us. I love that article.
That's a great article. And you know what, Montini has, he has been here, I believe he got here in 1980 and started working for the Arizona Republic. And over the years, he has written some incredible articles that touch on the emotional side of it. And he's very, very supportive of law enforcement. But everything he said in that was accurate. It's his opinion, and his opinion carries a lot of weight because of his experience. But there's nothing in there that is wrong.
And by the way, for those who don't know him, he also comes down heavy on law enforcement. There's times where he will absolutely criticize the department for doing something that they shouldn't do. So he's not like one of these that just loves blue and he writes based on that. He's extremely, I'll call it liberal. He's liberal and he has liberal views. A good guy. He paints it like he sees it. And I absolutely respect him.
Yeah,
that's
much.
Probably a good spot for us to end our cop talk.
Yeah, outstanding segment, Darren. Thank you for putting some insight, intellect, telling the rest of the story, some cases. And, you know, the point that everybody should take away from that, I do encourage everybody to watch the video. I do encourage everybody to learn and gain some perspective, especially police officers. But always remember there's more to the story, and do not let it deter you from doing your job the way you were trained and the way you are meant to be doing it, why you put your name on that application. This one event, that 30-second video, does not determine the rest of your career and the rest of your future. So, City of Phoenix, hang in there. Chief Jerry Williams, you're doing a good job. Hang in there, and we will be right back.
Stay safe.
More stories, inside guests, and true blue humor coming up on Badge Boys. We'll be back right after this.
I remember the moment.
I'll never forget that moment.
As long as I live.
As long as I live.
Several of us were working to rescue a family.
The house collapsed on top of the cellar door and trapped them.
We had to use Humvees and heavy machinery to move massive trees and debris.
We got them out.
We helped a lot of people out.
It felt good to know I could really make a difference.
Because I'm a citizen soldier in the National Guard.
Be there the moment your community needs you. Learn more at NationalGuard.com.
Sponsored by the Arizona National Guard. Aired by the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
Move over, AZ. Arizona's move over law requires you to move over or slow down when you drive past any vehicle pulled over with flashing lights. Remember, every vehicle, every time. Move over, AZ.
Sponsored by ADOT in partnership with the Arizona Broadcasters Association and this station.
You're listening to Badge Boys with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Now, back to the Badge Boys.
Well, that was a rousing cop talk episode segment. That was a good one, and hopefully a lot can be learned from that incident, and it's sad, and I hope that doesn't define this officer's entire career, because he's a 20-year veteran, and I'm sure he has a stellar career, and I just hope it doesn't define him. Now is a part that I love. This is when we talk about heroic headlines, we talk about inspirational moments, and I hand it over to no better person than Jason Schechterly to deal with the heroic and the inspirational.
Yes, let's put a little insight into what 99.99999 repeating officers do every single day. This is what the job is, this is why they do it, and this is what actually takes place. And I want to credit reporter Amy Knapp of The Independent in Massillon, Ohio. A little shout out to my best friend Brian, who would say the heart of it all, as Ohio is known, and it seems like there are an awful lot of people who are from Ohio, and they're going to be able to relate to that. Massillon, Ohio, despite heavy rain that was falling on the city this past Monday, things were pretty quiet. Patrolman Aaron Franklin was a little more than an hour into his shift when that all changed. Over the radio came a call for juveniles trapped in water. He raced to the scene. He was the first emergency responder to arrive. He found a teen boy who frantically told him that his friends had been swept into a culvert that carried Sipho Creek to the Tuscarawas River. The water rescue was just the beginning of a hectic day. Within just a few minutes, caught his breath after the water rescue, Franklin responded to a vehicle crash. Little did he know that within a span of less than 2 hours, he would be responsible for saving 6 lives.
Love it.
In 2 hours.
Love it.
You don't know that's coming. There's no script when you wake up that day. Hey, here's what's coming today. He saved 6 lives. Didn't threaten, didn't harm, didn't say things inappropriately. He saved people's lives, and today they are back at work, they are back with their families, and that's what we need to think about. It's all in a day's work. Nearly four-year veteran of the police department, Franklin, never had been on a water rescue. Those are scary, let me tell you. If you've never, the current can get pretty intense. He knew to keep this cool. After he learned that the kids were in the culvert, the officer made his way down a slippery embankment to assess the situation. The water was moving very fast. Hanging onto a tree limb, he peered into the large culvert and spotted two teens clinging onto the side of the culvert. They were unscathed and happy to see him. He told them to stay put. He climbed back out of the water. The boy's friend, who was able to escape and call for help, told Franklin that others may have been swept further into the pipe. Franklin advised fellow responding officers to make their way to the end of the spillway to search for the teens. Knowing he could easily become a victim if he entered the culvert, Franklin tried to keep the boys calm as they waited for the fire department to arrive. Fire Chief Bergasser didn't hesitate to join Franklin in the water, and tethered to a rope, donning a life jacket, the chief did this.
Love it.
Made his way into the culvert to rescue the boys. Franklin remained at the entrance, manning a life ring tied to the end of a rope. The pair, along with other firefighters and officers, managed to rescue the two boys. Two more remained further down the pipe, though. The third had traveled under the city a half mile through this culvert, where he was able to cling to a ladder. Yeah, I credit these teens for not giving up and staying in the fight. He could hear them yelling, but he couldn't make out what they were saying, Franklin said. I threw the life ring out there. Water rescues are not something you train for, he said, especially as a police officer. It's more making a split-second decision of what I should do, what can I do, and what am I going to do. Chief Vergasser praised Franklin for his efforts to save the boys. He was hanging onto a tree trunk in the water. There was no rope tied to him. The chief said it was a cooperative effort, and it took all of us. It was a scary situation that could have turned out differently. Wet and weary from the rescue, Franklin joined emergency personnel at station number one, where the teens were reunited with their family.
I love it.
And that is all that matters, right there. That is what officers are doing. And I love the part in there about the fire chief. Way to step up and not forget where you started also. You're the chief now. And it's like, here we go. I'm going to rescue some kids. And they put their lives on the line. And that's what these people do every day, regardless of the rare videos that you see and the rare words that you hear. That is not what 99.9% of the job is. These are the stories I love.
Yep, they're in our hearts. It really is. Well, I'm going to take us from life-saving to potentially life-losing. Del City, Oklahoma, fire crews went to a house fire with significant fire coming from the garage. There were no injuries that were reported. While questioning witnesses, fire investigators discovered that there was an ongoing conflict between neighbors in this community, including the home that went up in flames. The authorities spotted a surveillance system on a nearby home. They went to that homeowner and said, can we take a look? And the homeowner said, absolutely, come on in. So the fire officials discovered that the homeowner, where the surveillance video was, set the fire. That's right. Yes. That is correct.
Busted by your own camera.
Good Lord.
Yes. Oklahoma woman caught on her own camera setting the fire.
Annie
Burham, 59 years of age. She said, quote, all I know is I was in a house and saw smoke. I was like, somebody's going to fix it. This is before she was caught. There has been drug activity, addicts living in there. So she was upset and took matters in her own hands. And the authorities said, quote, regardless of the extent of a conflict, arson is never the solution. Wow. Wise words. And now to our inspirational moment.
Well, our inspirational moment this week, I just want to leave everybody with a thought for the day. One of my favorite people that I follow on Instagram puts on some great posts. And I've said it many times, every single day I have to find something to inspire me, something to motivate me. I am very lucky that I get to do it every single Wednesday. I get to come down here and I get to be with you, Darren, and Robin, and we get to do this show. And every Wednesday, I'm very lucky. I wake up and I'm fired up. I'm ready to go. I'm inspired and motivated. But the other 6 days of the week, it's like, all right, what is there today? And everybody's got to do that. And this quote meant something to me yesterday. And it said, I think what's wrong with the world is no one says what they really feel. They always hold it inside. They're sad, but they don't cry. They're happy, but they don't dance or sing. They're angry, but they don't scream. Because if they do, they feel ashamed. And feeling ashamed is the single worst feeling in the world. So everyone walks around with their heads down, and no one sees how beautiful the sky is. So meet yourself where you're at, feel what you're feeling. Don't forget to look up at the beautiful sky and remember how incredibly beautiful and precious this life is. Last minute shout out to EJ Montini. Thank you so much for that article. Darren, today's episode was awesome. Having Jack Valentine in here talking about that case, again, just brings up so many emotions and feelings for me from 14 years ago. I loved our cop talk, and I can't wait to do it all again next week. Robin.
Jason.
You have something to say.
Ugh, dude, you do it to me every time.
You always have something to say.
It's just the tears you put in my eyes.
Robin, how far along are you on your book?
I'm in, just finished chapter 12.
Woohoo! I can't wait till this book is done. A, because we're going to read it, but B, I'm going to get Robin out of her producer chair, and she's going to have to sit in between me and Darren and get interviewed. Now, won't that be fun?
Love it.
Well, I already have one book out. You don't have to wait till the second
one. No, we're going to wait for the second one, and I want to read it and get my emotions going on that. So Thank you, everybody. Great show today. God bless, and we will see you next week.
Batch Boys. Thanks for listening to Batch Boys. Stories, insights, guests, and true blue humor with retired police sergeant Darren Birch and retired police officer Jason Schechterly. Batch Boys, heard weekly and worldwide on Star Worldwide Networks and all mobile devices. Batch Boys.